I would I don't, do you want the slides? Do you need the slides?
I think we're absolutely fine, up to you, Hayley. So I just want to say a warm welcome. Apologies, we've had a few technical issues, but we're getting through it at the moment. I'm also recovering from a cough, so apologies. So firstly, just want to say hi everybody. Thank you so much for joining today's online panel session, where we'll be looking at how women shape the net zero transition beyond COP26, and our first ever joint event with the Women Utilities Network. So really excited to be doing our joint event together. My name's Anne Merkovich. I'm an associate director at Connect Group and executive committee member at Women in Public Affairs. Just a bit of background blurb on WIPA. We were established in 2012, the aim of bringing together women across all areas of the public affairs industry. We've run events like this to provide advice, share experiences, but also to network and build friendships with women at all levels in the industry. In today's session, we'll be hearing from some excellent speakers on the significance of COP26, the opportunities for women in shaping the net zero transition, and advice for women on the call today looking to make an impact on policymaking. You know, those in the public affairs industry know too well that there is gender inequality when it comes to decision making. You can see this, you know, looking at you know, pensions gap, for example, looking through successive governments. You look at the BEIS department, we're mainly looking at net zero, mainly male ministers. So got a really exciting discussion ahead of us, and given we're coming out of COP26, I think it's really important time to be having this conversation. So we've got a really great panel ahead of us. We'll be talking to Rebecca Sedler, who's Director of Policy and Regulation at EDF and co-founder of Women Utilities Network, Philippa Oldham, who's Stakeholder Engagement Director of the Advanced Propulsion Centre, Lois Toole, who is International Programmes Manager at the Conservative Environment Network, Juliet Phillips, who's Senior Policy Advisor at Clean Economy for E3G, and Jo Butlin, CEO of Energy Bridge and co-founder of Women Utilities Network. Just in terms of housekeeping, if you could please put your questions in the chat and we'll come to them after the speakers have finished. When we are also recording today's session as well, so you can listen to this after the panel has finished. So I'm going to hand over to our first speaker of today, Rebecca Sedler. Rebecca, over to you.
Thanks, Anne, and hello, everyone. Do I start with the positive or do I start with the negative? So, you know, we're here, many of us work in the energy and policy and government affairs sectors and spend and commit a lot of our time towards net zero and decarbonisation topics because it's got such a strong purpose and one that we're, you know, many of us are committed to. To me, I last, you know, in my current role, I kind of eat, sleep and breathe it, to be honest. And, you know, there's never been a year with as many kind of public targets and ambitions as there has been this year in the UK following the Energy White Paper and all the different sectoral strategies, whether related to hydrogen or heat decarbonisation, transport decarbonisation, all running up to COP and the UK's presidential term hosting the International Climate Summit. And this is incredibly motivating in some ways because we're recognising the kind of all-encompassing efforts that all areas of the economy and society essentially need to make to for us to progress net zero. But when we reflect this on diversity, there does seem to be something lacking. I mean, we are, when we're talking about net zero, although we often talk about the policy side of it and the weird kind of political and government acronyms that no one understands. I mean, if you actually survey people, very few people understand what net zero is, let alone a kind of national determined carbon target and all the rest of it. It's a societal challenge, existential challenge, that's increasingly embraced by all levels of society across different kind of demographics. But if you look and see who are really making the decisions and setting the targets and really, you know, having the final say across politics and in business, it's overwhelmingly men. You know, if I reflect on COP, and, you know, there were many successes at COP, and one of the biggest for me was the involvement in business, you know, the fact it did have a big corporate face. Another one, it had such a huge youth following, and whether the activism was taking place inside the summit or outside is another discussion. But, you know, again, it wasn't just kind of confined to the sustainability experts. It really was cross, you know, reaching across different segments of the population. What was really awful was that picture of all the world leaders stood on the stage, because when that picture came out and I looked at it, and it was just basically like loads of men and three women. I think one of them was dressed in yellow in order to get noticed. I just thought, oh my God, it's another one of those pangs that you sometimes feel as a woman in business, where you kind of don't feel included. And I think it's, you know, really disappointing that there must be many people, many citizens that look at a lot of, you know, who are making the decisions around this. Don't just think it's a gender thing. I've frequently heard about younger sections of the population not feeling that their voice is heard in net zero and in policy making, etc. And I'm sure if you go across to other marginalized groups, they'd be the same. But that picture for me was a particularly poignant moment for CARP, and something that made me realize that we certainly have more progress to make. I won't talk about, you know, the horrible figures that we can all research on how many CEOs of the top UK companies are female versus male, or how still the struggles that we have to have women in engineering, for example, or across STEM, when we have probably the biggest infrastructure challenge ever in this country to decarbonize assets ahead of us. But, you know, it's clear that if we're going to make the progress we need to make and take citizens and all members of society with us, we have to have an inclusive, diverse, representative section of the population pioneering, leading the strategy for this. So, yeah, I'll be interested to hear what other people have got to say on this particular topic. And sorry to kind of start with a bit of a rant about COP, but I thought it was something that very public that probably resonated with a lot of people on this call.
Thanks so much, Rebecca. And not a rant at all. I think it's a really important point to make. I'm going to hand over to our next speaker, who is Philippa Oldham, Stakeholder Engagement Director, the Advanced Propulsion Centre. Philippa, over to you.
Sorry, and the doorbell has just gone with a delivery, as you always imagine at the moment, so Christmas shopping online. So thank you for having me today. So my background is transport. So yeah, as you said, Anne, Stakeholder Engagement. Can I pass and come back? Is that all right? Sorry.
You can pass and come back. That's fine. I'm going to move on, Philippa, to Lois first, and then I'll come back to you. So I'm going to hand on to Lois Toole, who is the International Programmes Manager at Conservative Environment Network. Lois, over to you.
Thanks very much, Anne. I have the opportunity to speak as well. I think it's a really important discussion, and I've been asked to give the more international politics angle of this. So I thought I'd start with some of the key points and agreements from COP26. So the Glasgow Climate Pact gives us a chance to accelerate the transition to a cleaner, greener and more resilient global economy. And women will play a major part in this transition. We've seen the landmark global agreement to end and reverse deforestation by 2030, which was reached. This is going to cover over 85% of the world's forests, but in forestry, especially even in the Nordics, where this is a huge industry, women are very underrepresented in that industry. We've also seen the Global Methane Pledge, which aims to limit methane emissions by 30% compared with 2020 levels. Although the final agreement in Glasgow doesn't go far enough on phasing out coal power, it marked the first time that such a resolution had been made under the UN climate process. And NGOs such as Greenpeace have acknowledged that a signal has been sent that the era of coal is ending. So when the UK took over the presidency of COP, 30% of global GDP was covered by net zero targets. Since then, there's been a huge shift over the last 2 years under the UK's leadership, and now it's over 90%. Of course, these pledges must be translated into action, and crucially, policymakers should consider the relevance of gender to climate change. climate change disproportionately affects women, as we've heard from the previous speaker, particularly in developing countries, and this is mostly due to existing gender inequalities. This exacerbates the impacts of increased flooding, droughts, and food insecurity that are made more frequent and extreme by climate change. According to the UN, more women are killed by natural disasters than men, which I think is really shocking, while 80% of people displaced by climate change are women. It's therefore essential that we highlight the voices of those who are vulnerable to climate impact, especially women, and support countries on the front line of climate change to build climate resilience. It can also act as a threat multiplier, which deepens existing inequalities and puts more pressure on areas in conflict. Bangladesh is a prime example of this. By 2050, it's estimated that one in every seven people in Bangladesh is likely to be displaced by climate change. So women's testimonies in particular are crucial to better understanding. Internationally, we can help to highlight the experience of women, young people, and marginalized groups while boosting trade and investment in the green economy among our international partners. While domestically, we can champion the opportunities for businesses and STEM employers, such as in the UK's leading offshore wind sector, to be gender inclusive. As the UK retains a COP presidency, it has a unique role and responsibility to promote collective action across the world that's inclusive of those who are most vulnerable to the effects of climate change. So how can we empower women to be more involved in these responses to climate change and in policy making? I think the main thing is that we need to encourage more women to be involved in the conversation in the first place. So the UN's Women Report has found that only 28% of managerial positions globally were held by women in 2019. And this is quite striking because it's almost the same proportion as in 1995. I don't want to give you loads of figures about CEOs, as the previous speaker mentioned, but it really shows that in political and in business life, women's representation might have doubled or might have increased a little bit, but it's not even reached a quarter of parliamentary seats globally. Also, women's representation among cabinet ministers has increased a little bit, but as we saw from that picture, there's really not many people on the world stage, and only 21% of government ministers are women. So it's not surprising, unfortunately, that climate delegations are gender imbalanced. I think there is more to do, but we've made some progress. And a great example in the Conservative Party is Women to Win. So this is an organisation that was set up by Theresa May and Baroness Jenkin to encourage more women to stand for office. And they have a really key campaign called Ask Her to Stand. So you can do this to your friends or your peers or your colleagues even, ask them to stand for office or ask them to just stand up for themselves, I guess, women's voices to be more heard. So when it was set up 15 years ago, there were only 17 women Conservative MPs, and now there's 87. So there's much more work to be done, but this is a really good step. And more female representation in Parliament isn't just better for democracy, it's better for modern Britain. And in terms of SEN, Conservative Environment Network, we've seen a lot of former SEN MPs, so we only work with backbenchers, but a lot of the people who have left the backbenchers and now gone into government are in prominent roles in Boris Johnson's cabinet. So we've got Vicky Ford, who's in the Foreign Office, Rachel McLean in Transport, and Victoria Prentice and Rebecca Powell in DEFRA. Catherine Fletcher is also a great example on the backbenchers from our current MPs of female representation in climate change. She often deputised for Alok Sharma at COP, so I think she was one of the key players there on the Conservative benches at least. And she's a proud Northerner, so I definitely relate to her. So I'm going to wrap up. In Parliament and policymaking, I think it's so important that women are at the forefront of the response to climate change. And this is just one step we can take.
Great, thanks so much, Lewis. And thanks for those stats as well, really interesting. And good to hear about Women to Win too. So thanks for mentioning that. Philippa, I'm going to hand over to you. Hopefully the parcel was delivered safely.
Yeah, luckily it's wine, so I'm very happy. Just to pick up, so yeah, thanks for inviting me. And picking up on a number of things. So obviously coming from the transport world, it is quite different, and I'm an engineer myself, and it's quite interesting.
Oh, are you back?
Sorry, can you hear me?
I can hear you now, yep.
Okay, so sorry. I've worked across a number of engineering sectors, so auto, aero, defence, and then I moved into the policy world probably about 10 years ago, representing engineers in manufacturing and transport, and then I joined the APC 4 years ago. And, you know, what's interesting is sort of back in October, they gave me the role of managing the communications and marketing function as well, which is for an engineer, very bizarre, some people would say. We're not known as a profession that is good at communicating. So that's quite interesting. But actually, I think that comes from being a female, actually. And the women that I've worked with who are engineers, you know, and are capable is, and the power that women have is we communicate well, much better. We can take complex topics and simplify them and make them accessible for everybody, and actually have the capability to join things together and potentially look at problems differently. And that's something that we really miss in engineering design. And have done in the past. I've definitely seen that in my experience. But what's really sort of, just to do a stat, you know, women in engineering now is at 14%. And that's actually a 25% increase since 2016. So, you know, we are shifting the dial, which is brilliant. But I suppose taking it to COP from my side of it, transport decarbonisation is a massive challenge. You know, 25% of all the emissions come from transport in the UK. But one of the real issues I see going forward is that, you know, great that we're setting timelines and, you know, banning the sale of fossil fueled vehicles, both in passenger car and heavy duty. But actually, all you're doing is shifting the emissions to the extraction of the materials and the production side of things. And if we're not careful, we're just going to end up with a big problem further down the line. And actually accessing the materials that go into these vehicles is a real challenge. And that security of supply chain is a real issue. And actually, when you see that, you know, 80% of the rare earths, for example, that go into our electric machines in the permanent magnets, so whether that be in our wind turbines, in our vehicles, you know, that those mines and that processing is managed by China, you know, so actually we are very vulnerable in accessing some of these materials. So we have to think more broadly about that. And you know, that is a big issue. And like you say, there's multiple men. I said, you know, to the speakers before we came on, I was at my first black tie do for 2 years last night. So the SMMT annual dinner, I think there were probably about 500 people there. I think there were probably about 20 women in total. What was great was that Trudy Harrison, who's the DFT, Department for Transport Minister for Decarbonisation, was there. I've spoken to Trudy a number of times. She came to, we have a big low carbon vehicle show every year in Millbrook, and she was there then. And what's great about Trudy is she's an MP for Copplands, and so where Sellafield is. And her work experience was in Sellafield, and her dad was an engineer. And, you know, I took her around and she saw robotic arms. And so she understands manufacturing, or, you know, she's worked on a production line where she's seen that. And I think we have to engage women about the challenges to make them join the profession and see how we can change things. And I think one of the things that we have the capability to do is address how we can work together. And actually, you know, I suppose me being on this call was introduced by, you know, another one the founders, Laura, to join, is that it's really important for collaboration going forward. And, you know, I work in, you know, transport, and it's an international market, and there's a huge, huge issue. And, you know, Rebecca mentioned, you know, the hydrogen strategy that's come out this year. There's no real mention of transport or the end users in how we get that green hydrogen. And that's a real issue for people manufacturing the vehicles, because they don't know how to access it. And actually what you're seeing is that women, we tend to pick up the phone more rather than just email people. I think we're quite happily get something done often because we've got very busy lives. I know everybody has very busy lives at the moment, but actually, you know, we know that a 5-minute conversation on the phone will get something done much quicker than putting an email in somebody's inbox and nothing happening. And to me, I think it's really powerful with the ladies that I've known, I mean, in policy and public affairs, when they move around. I mean, interestingly, my senior PR manager, she's come from the police as her background and also worked in energy. She was part of the Women Energy Network. And, you know, that experience and those contacts, and that's the point, we always join those dots. You know, who do we know in different sectors, who can we introduce people, and I'm always looking at where we can help add value, and I think that is one of the biggest challenges we don't have when we don't have visible females in our organizations, is that you miss those connections and that opportunity to help accelerators. And some of the commitments that we've got to deliver on net zero are going to be really, really, really challenging. I can't emphasize that enough. And unless people are collaborating and working together and joining up and not working in their silos, which a lot of men traditionally do, we're not going to get there. And that's a real concern to me.
Thanks so much, Philippa. And a really important point about collaboration. Completely agree with that. I'm going to hand over to Juliet Phillips, who's Senior Policy Advisor for Clean Economy at E3G. Juliet, over to you.
Hi, everyone. I'll just start by saying I'm definitely not an expert on climate diplomacy or the intricacies of COP26. My main day-to-day focus is on place-based transitions, specifically focused on energy efficiency and low carbon heat. So when answering the question of how women can shape the net zero transition beyond 26, I thought I'd translate some key takeaways from my perspective about COP into the UK context for women working on net zero before setting out some of my own domestic priorities for place-based transitions over the coming months. So first, three key observations for me from COP and thoughts of what that means for women working on net zero. And first, I think the meeting served as a really important reminder that we're in such a race against time for net zero. Keeping 1.5 alive is more than just a slogan for small island developing states, as well as other climate vulnerable countries. Every percentage of a degree really matters as sea levels rise and famines grow more intense. And as Lois and others have mentioned, women are disproportionately affected by all of this. And this matters for the work which we do in the UK. There's really no time for distraction, for greenwash or half measures. We really need to be as ambitious as we can, I think, and not be scared to be more demanding and aspiring and really push for those systematic and systemic changes which we need. And a second key takeaway for me was the power dynamics at stake and how we saw that play out in terms of decision-making around net zero. COP was obviously supposedly a global discussion, but we saw real politics at play. And I think that's just a harsh reminder of how processes in general favor those who already have power and resources and these hierarchies entrench. And I think many of us would know that this is a largely unfair way of making progress, and it could leave certain voices excluded or marginalized and often worsens the situation for those most vulnerable. And I think there's lessons here too for women working in net zero, particularly in public affairs, when sometimes it can feel a bit Machiavellian, you have the incentive to play the game to win the game. But I think there's more we can do to reshape unfair rules, which do benefit certain voices and challenge some of those power dynamics within our own sector. And a final point about celebrating female leadership, and as a number of speakers have pointed out, there's not enough women at the top, but those who are generally brilliant. There's a few notable examples from COP, including Mia Motley, the Prime Minister of Barbados, who was an incredible force, speaking truth to power and really cutting through, as well as the activists on the outside. And I think it's worth mentioning Vanessa Nakate and Greta Thunberg, the brilliant climate justice activists. And I think those working for net zero, we can really amplify and platform these leaders across the sector. And back to the domestic context quickly, I'll whistle through what our near-term priorities are for place-based transitions post-COP. And as it was noted, we still have the COP presidency, and we really want to make sure that we can enshrine this legacy of the Glasgow Pact. But following the heat and building strategy and the spending review, there's still some really big gaps for getting on track for net zero. And energy efficiency, particular for the owner-occupier sector, is a really big one of these. And whilst it's perhaps the slightly less glamorous cousin in the net zero world, it's going to be absolutely essential for any plans to decarbonise heat and other sectors. So we'll be pushing for more progress on this. Another big issue was the lack of investment and resourcing across the across the whole sector, really, but place-based transitions, energy efficiency and heat really saw a shortfall, something like 10 billion short of what's needed to get on track for net zero homes this Parliament. So looking forward, we'll be working with the UK Infrastructure Bank, as well as looking at the towards the 2022 budget as well, to get more commitments from government. And finally, we need to focus on delivery as well, good delivery. These building strategies set a good direction of travel for low carbon heat with regulatory timelines for phasing out fossil fuel heating systems. But we really need to turn those announcements into action with a focus on jobs, skills, retraining, as well as boosting consumer support and advice as we make these changes to our homes. So those are some reflections from me, and yeah, very keen to work more with people who are interested in those areas going forward.
Great, thanks so much, Julia, and thanks for mentioning decarbonising heat and homes. I know that's quite a huge challenge ahead, and it's going to be affecting all of our households. So definitely one to look into. Moving on to our last but certainly not least speaker, Jo Butlin, CEO of Energy Bridge and co-founder of Women's Utilities Network. So Jo, over to you.
Great, thanks Anne. And there's nothing like being last on a list of eminent people to sort of come up with something new or different. I'll start actually just by talking about One for the WIPA members who maybe are not aware of what One is. And I think it's fair to say that the founders of One started it because we were looking around the sector and the statistics of women at senior roles in the utilities sector are woeful and are still woeful, but getting better. And the focus of One is very much practically focused. So it's all about actually what are the tools that we can help women with to develop their careers and move up the ladder. And that's both sort of technical knowledge-based activity, but also sort of personal development. So when I was thinking about, you know, COP and women and where do we go from here, it's very, very easy to get very depressed very quickly by a lot of what's already been said in terms of, you know, the representation and what's there. But taking a step back, I sort of thought, actually, in terms of the landscape that we're now in, almost the two things that nobody seems to argue about anymore is we need more diversity and we need to address climate change. And those two things, you rarely hear dissenting voices. How you get there is a lot harder, but actually you don't hear that dissenting voices. So part of me was going, actually, the time is right to pull those two things together and really leverage the sentiment and the sort of the space that we're in now. And then I was just reflecting, One actually ran last week, 2 weeks ago, a really, really good whole day on careers. And we covered all sorts of different areas on sort of what it takes to get recruited, how to present yourself, and then what recruiters are looking for. Bear with me, it'll come relevant. The biggest message that came out of that, and the one that resonates with me and I keep talking about, is be brave. And I think for women, we're very good at not being brave. We're very good at sort of looking around the table and not stepping forward. And I think here, there is the opportunity to really be brave and take a lead and to step forward and to be the people making the noise. And then really picking up on Juliet's point in terms of, you know, the domestic environment, one of the biggest challenges of climate change is behavioural change. And actually to get people to do things differently. And for me, you know, we have the ability as women to showcase that behavioural change, be it in a domestic environment, be it in a work environment, and to shout about it. So actually, it feels to me that whilst it's flipping hard, and we're all, I laughed at Philippa's example of the sort of the black tie do, because we've all been there when you walk into the room and you're the only woman, or in a very small minority, you know, you all get used to that, but actually being brave, using that to your advantage, you know, standing out because you can, being the one in the yellow dress, you know, that is our opportunity. And so for me, it's that mixture of the climate and diversity environment is right. You know, that the time is right for us. The behavioural change is our real opportunity, I think, in terms of where we can differentiate ourselves and really showcase way forward. You know, the domestic environment is largely managed, controlled, led by women. So let's sort of showcase that. And then the last piece is, you know, let's just be brave and take those opportunities. If the time is right, then now is the time to do it. So there's a bit of a rah, rah, rah there. But I think for me, that's the, you know, we're not going to flip it overnight. The last point I would say, you know, one, we're absolutely delighted. You know, it's grown. We've got over 2,500 members now. And actually, it's that collective voice and it's that consistent messaging that we can actually really harness and move forward and sort of get into government, get some lobbying, get some views of women, get the views of. And actually, that for me is the opportunity as well, is how do we, you know, really utilise our networks that we've got to get our voice heard. And that was probably my little ramble. Back to Anne.
No ramble, Jo. That's just absolutely great advice. I really like the be brave comment too. Please do ask questions in the chat box. I'm going to use my priority as chair to ask my first question. This is to all the panellists. So I was wondering, do you think COP has played a part in recognising the need that women need to play more of a role, a prominent role in the net zero transition? Or do you think it was just kind of another event? Here we go. Next year is going to be the same problem. I am going to pick on Rebecca first, if that's okay.
I think, as Jo says, the business case for diversity is clear. And, you know, if you take that to decarbonisation or sustainability targets, there's a plethora of research that will show you more diverse boards of companies deliver more ambitious targets faster, et cetera, et cetera. I think there's a big difference, though, between having a belief set and even a value set to actually actioning it. And, you know, I see that as a senior leader in a very big business every day. And that's not because there isn't the willingness. It's because, you know, translating that into something practical, doable in a very often high-pressured, short-of-time environment is challenging. You know, it has to be front of mind all the time. And sometimes it means introducing inconvenience and perhaps educating yourself a little bit in some areas. I often find the translation of policy and strategy into, you know, lived experience and behaviours, which is, of course, what ultimately is needed to change to deliver against net zero, quite misguided. And you know, quite often I'll be in a room with men talking about, well, this means that drivers, if we're talking about transportation, let's talk about EVs and decarbonisation of transport, for example. I'm talking about the impact that an insufficient, geographically kind of unequal charging infrastructure across the UK will have, and who, and you know, there's a lot of research to show that the effect that could have on female drivers, and particularly because there's extra concerns for female drivers such as safety, which often, you know, a lot of my male colleagues don't think that there's an issue if they had to stop at some kind of random charging place in the middle of, I don't know, I'll pick on Suffolk, Joe, because, you know, sometimes I go there because we've got an existing power station and possibly a very huge infrastructure project starting there. You know, some on some random roads which might not be working when I'm short of charge, that might be a concern for me and something that might put me off making a switch to EV. Equally, you know, there's often this narrative about, well, you know, you can stop off at when you're doing a long drive and charge at a service station while you're having your coffee. Again, as a mother of three small young children, that doesn't really typically reflect my experience of traveling, and not nor that of many, many, many of my female peers. So do you see what I mean? It's just this really weird, almost naive translation and kind of myopic understanding of lived experiences. And so I think, yeah, the, you know, the desire is there. You know, generally people want to do the right thing, and they, you know, a lot of the male leaders that are at the top of the large organizations have daughters that they want to do well, thrive, you know, have exactly the same opportunities as they did. But it's, you have to make the effort, you have to, you know, you have to take action. And I guess, you know, that's what our networks are all about, right? So that's why we're here today.
Great, thanks, Rebecca. And I think that's a really important point, the kind of what's policy and what's actually going to be practical. Great, given you mentioned transport, I'm going to go over to Philippa and say, Philippa, do you want to come back on this question at all?
Just to add really to Rebecca's, they're really badly lit as well, charging stations. So if you're there at night, that nobody's thought about putting a light on them. I don't know whether it's because when they've been designed, we all go to petrol stations at the moment, obviously that's all very much lit up. But yeah, you can't actually see what the hell you're doing. You try and plug a car in at night. So that's again a negative point. But and it is, and almost picking on transport, but a longer time, and you know, this is a bit of a challenge around engineers, is like the seatbelt. You know, if women had been involved in seatbelt design, we'd have a 5-point, like a racing seatbelt. You know, the amount of women who had miscarriages due to having bumps and not having their seatbelt in the right position, you know, still happens, you know, because it was designed by a man and that wasn't taken into consideration. And it is a challenge, and I think that we have to think about interpretation of policy and how you get there. And I don't necessarily think COP really did anything for diversity or inclusion. And I think that policy is put into place without understanding the implications sometimes as well. And again, that can be a really, you know, we know from this government, they like headlines, and actually how we deliver on those headlines is problematic sometimes. I mean, or challenging, you know, opportunity. I was in an event recently and I think every other word was opportunity. But it is really difficult. And interestingly, I was in a meeting, I think we're all, you know, doing this hybrid working, and you know, as part of my exec, we're talking about how we go back to work, you know, and putting targets on it. And the reflection that I'm a single parent mum, and I, you know, get to see my daughter, and I've been away a lot, and actually recognise I only have her 50% of the time, so I want to see her more. But you know, I was told that, you know, by other members of my exec, that Ford used to have always been at the forefront and had very good childcare policies. Of which my response was, so how did your wife find that when she was a stay-at-home mum looking after your three kids? You know, you must have really tested that policy. And actually, you know, and again, I was on a call with Bosch last week, and they did a caring responsibilities webinar, and you know, talking about, you know, people caring for elderly parents and things like that. And one lady apologized because she wasn't looking after children, but she was looking after her parents. And it's that whole, people feel they have to apologize for their situation or their life, and that needs to change, because we live in a world where actually everything can be personalized. You know, where we travel, where we work, how we get our shopping delivered or go out and do it, you know, which everything is our own choice. And actually the workplace needs to change again with the behaviors and how we reflect that in our daily jobs, you know, putting our contracts on it. And I get there's an amount of trust that has to be put on the individual, but we've all just bloody worked at home for the last 18 months. You know, people can be trusted to deliver. I think most of us are busier than we've ever been. And we're all delivering, but we've still got to have that work-life balance. And that is something that is really hard at the moment. And especially as we start going back to the office, going back to our events, going back to meetings in London or wherever in the country it is, Suffolk, you know, that takes time, that travel, and that has to be worked back into our lives. And so that's a behavioral change, but we need to learn from actually the pandemic about how we integrate that into our lives for the better. And actually some of that will have an impact on inclusivity and also on mitigating the effects of our emissions. You know, let's not travel to meetings. We know we don't have to. So let's reduce the emissions. And actually all of these behavioral changes, we need to learn and reflect on what we've done and not just go back to what we used to do. Because actually that will help shift both, again, the dial on both that inclusivity and that emissions piece.
I think we could do a whole other session on, you know, lessons from pandemic, but no, really great points, Philippa. Lois, I'm going to come over to you on COP26 from the international perspective. Do you think things have changed?
To be honest, I would agree with the other two panellists that it hasn't really moved the dial. I think, well, there was a specific gender day, which I don't think they've had before, I might be wrong. And there was a lot more diversity in panel discussions. People did talk about it a bit more, as far as I noticed. But I think it was more seen by the absence of women and the picture that was mentioned, that you only have a few leaders, maybe Ursula von der Leyen, I guess the Swedish Prime Minister and a few others who are women at the top table. It's similar to what I said in my opening remarks, only 21% of government ministers around the world are women. So the key to all this is just getting women more into these policy-making roles and into politics. I think the COP unit itself had quite a good gender balance in terms of their whole employees, but in terms of the top team, you've probably got Anne-Marie Trevelyan and a few of the ambassadors as well, but the top team, like you mentioned, for Bayes is very male dominated. I mean, they may be the best person for the job at the time, but there also needs to be some female representation in there as well.
Great, thanks so much, Lois. Yeah, I completely agree. Juliet, do you want to come in on this question at all?
Yeah, not tons to add on top of what everyone else has already said. But I suppose from my own world of working in buildings, I'm often in a room when I'm the only person not called Nigel or Christopher. So I can definitely relate to some of those comments. But having worked mainly in the charity sector, which is, I would say, has a much higher representation of females, it does make me think about how people are socialised to think that certain sectors or careers are better suited for them, and just the need for more kind of education at a younger age for people to realise that, you know, if you want to go into climate, that doesn't necessarily just mean you have to go into into the charity sector, but there's opportunities more broadly available. So maybe just adding that point to the great comments made by others.
Great, thanks so much, Juliet. And Jo, is there anything you'd like to add?
It's tricky being the last, isn't it? I'll firstly say Suffolk is a very safe place. You're more likely to meet a tractor than anything else, or a fox. No, I think that the piece I would just, I suppose I do sound a bit like a stuck record, but, you know, now is the time when opportunities are going to be presented to women because of this diversity drive. And so I think it is about, you know, really taking that step to say everything we're saying on this call, and making it really clear that the practical, the realistic, the reality of what it means to women is not what is assumed by men, and so therefore it's, you know, it's up to us to sort of almost push that forward, and, you know, if there's a little chink in the door, then kick it down. You know, it's really, I mean, I just feel quite strongly the time is right. You know, that there's people are actively recruiting and looking for women in senior roles. And, you know, they are trying to bring diversity to senior roles. So if you get the opportunity, don't do what's typical of women and go, I can't do 40% of this job, I can do 30%. You know, it just go for it. Because actually, I think that we will surprise ourselves as much as everybody else. And then you have a voice at the table.
Thanks so much, Jo. Let's kick down those doors. I'm going to move on to some of the questions that are in the chat. Julia Root Gutteridge, would you like to come in and ask your question?
Oh, yeah, I'll just go back to the wording. As energy prices increase, which I think Mark Carney said we should be prepared for any energy prices to increase as we green the country, and taxes potentially go up to fund the green revolution, how do we protect women's financial status? Particularly as I don't have the stats to back this up, but I imagine that women are more likely to be higher proportionally affected by these increased costs and higher taxes than men. So how do we protect women from the impact of that?
Thanks so much, Julia. Does anyone want to come in? Jo, I'm kind of looking at you because I've left you last twice now, so I don't know whether you want to come in on this one.
Becca, or I could talk to this one for a while. I mean, fuel poverty is a massive challenge, and I think let's not kid ourselves, we haven't seen anything yet. You know, the price cap at the moment is artificially suppressing energy prices. And, you know, we will be looking from next April. I almost read a daily forecast of what the costs are going to be. But, you know, the collapse of the supply industry and the reality of wholesale costs and the energy transition, sort of the investment, is huge. Does it impact women disproportionately? I suppose I'm not totally convinced of that. I think it's a bigger issue. I think the whole fuel poverty issue is a bigger state. I think affordability is a key challenge, going back to policy and government, and actually the structure of the industry and who funds what where, and making it proportionate to, you know, carbon emitting would be a really good way of going, rather than just treating everybody as equal. So I think it's probably a bigger issue than just about women, but I think it's a massive issue in terms of the cost of decarbonisation and how we move forward.
Thanks, Jo. I'm going to go to Juliet and then Rebecca. Juliet, over to you.
Thanks. Yeah, I think this is such an important issue, and I think one of the themes which is probably going to define politics, but also net zero over the coming months. And from our perspective, there's so much which could be done to protect consumers against volatile international gas markets, and energy efficiency really is an unsung hero in all of this. We did some research recently at E3G, which found that the average household could save up to £500 per year on their energy bills with the right energy efficiency measures in place. I'll drop a link to that research into the chat. But yeah, I think there's so much more the government could be doing to support domestic energy efficiency as a way to protect consumers and mitigate against fuel price bill increases. But moreover, this needs to be backed up by short-term steps as well to support fuel-poor households. We've seen in Wales there's been this announcement of short-term funding to help people through the winter, and I think it's really important to have those measures as well as the kind of longer medium-term plans. And finally, something else the government can do is look to rebalance the economics of heat. So currently, around 25% of the electricity bills made up of legacy policy costs and eco levies. So if the government removed those, which has got precedent, we've done it previously and Germany's done it recently, that could save a big chunk of the costs for fuel poor, but also other households as well who are likely to face rising bills.
Thanks so much, Juliet. Rebecca.
So I guess having been at round tables with the minister on this subject every week for pretty much 3 months, I can give some insight on some of the facts, particularly with regards to affordability, I guess. You know, it's as Jo says, we've largely been protected from the full weight of the increases of energy prices driven by global gas prices because of the price cap, which is due, if you look at the numbers, to go up by about £400 in April. It'll be announced in February. At that point, an organisation like EDF, which has 5 million customers and a huge business supply, will be inundated with contacts from very, very worried customers wondering how on earth they are going to manage such an increase in their direct debits. At the same time, we know that inflation is increasing pretty rapidly, and if you have a look and see what the forecast for inflation could go to, it's pretty worrying. You know, there's an overall cost of living challenge. If you translate that to kind of the lower earning deciles in this country, like people who have, you know, less than £15,000 a year disposable income, they currently spend about 7 to 8% of that income on energy. In a year, that's probably going to increase to about 13%. Now, the sort of typical figure for what constitutes as fuel poverty is 10%. And if you use that, we're assuming that at least 2 million more households get pushed into fuel poverty. And that's just supply. That's not talking about investments in heat decarbonisation, the capital expenditure required for infrastructure, whether it's grid, nuclear power, whatever it is, that ultimately needs to be funded. I completely agree with the point on energy efficiency. You know, we've got to improve. You know, we are EDF, a massive provider of ECO, the energy company obligation, which provides all kinds of energy efficiency services, but we've got to recognise the customer experience of this could be much better. The standards, the regulation, quality could be much better. And indeed, you know, we've often talked about what needs to happen to the heat pump industry for it to grow to achieve the installation set out in the 10-point plan. You know, we often forget that the aside from the economics, which absolutely need addressing, both from a kind of operational perspective to make electric powers cheap to run, if not cheaper than gas, and to bring the capex down of actually buying a heat pump, but the experience of it needs to be good. I don't know if anyone's ever had contracted for any energy efficiency. I had some loft insulation done. It really wasn't the best experience. the best kind of non-stress inducing transaction I've ever gone through in my life. You know, we just have to be real about that. We have to improve it. If you talk about for women are the vast majority of caregivers in this country, whether it's to young children or to older parents. They are at home more, therefore they are much more vulnerable to prices, bills going up. That's a fact. And also, if you think about, right, well, I need stuff done to my house, whether it's heating, energy efficiency, even a smart meter, right? I've got to often let a man, because often it's men who do these field works services, technician services, into my house. Again, the what can we do to kind of make that more of a safer and welcome experience. I mean, these are the kind of calls and queries that we have at EDF every day that we try and work through. But yeah, I mean, the affordability, what the role of government is going to be on this, how it's not just also a consumer challenge, but also a business challenge, because, you know, we're headed towards a very big business contracting round in April, and businesses must be looking at these prices and just thinking, how on earth do I continue to run, let alone how do I invest in the infrastructure that's required for net zero, like, you know, decarbonizing my fleet or whatever. And I think that we've got to be able to talk about affordability and the energy transition and just transition all together without this becoming this polarized debate that if you challenge the cost, then you must be a climate change denier. That's like the most frustrating narrative that I see all the time. We've got to work on it together. But I believe there's much more progressive ways of funding this than the government currently have the ambition to do.
Great, thanks so much, Rebecca. Lois or Philippa, do you want to come in at all, or do you want me to quickly move to the next question? Great, I'm just conscious of time, so I'm going to bring in Sabrina Polito for her question, but I wondered if speakers mind just kind of concluding with their kind of remarks by giving attendees listening today just kind of one thing to take away from today's call as well. So Sabrina, do you want to ask your question?
Yeah, thanks, Anne. So I guess all the panellists have kind of touched on this, but what do you think women can or should be doing at an individual and collective level to have an impact and drive the net zero debate?
Great, thank you so much. Philippa, I'm going to come to you.
Leading by example, I said I'm a single parent mum, I'm a director, I'm driving the change of our business. You know, I work in a sector that's majority men, as many of us do. And so just trying to display good behaviours to hopefully lead the way and to encourage people to make those choices. And whilst it is the challenges around females being, you know, the main caregivers that Rebecca touched on, you know, as we rise up the food chain and do get those better paid jobs, men will be staying at home. I do have a few colleagues where actually they do a lot of the childcare responsibility. And so actually it has to be inclusive and fair for everybody. And I think that's the point, is it needs to be a fair system. So to me, and I think the sort of takeaway is some of these things take time. It does take time to change things. It takes time to change policy. It takes time to educate people. But that's why we have to display the right behaviours and sort of lead the way. And as Jo says, be bold.
Thanks so much, Philippa. Julia, I'm really sorry. I appreciate you've got to head off. So I'm going to come to you next, if that's okay.
Thanks. Sorry, I have to leave abruptly at two. But I suppose just to build on those comments, of course, yeah, we can definitely lead by example, but I think also as much as we can do to kind of raise the voice and kind of unpick some of those systemic and more kind of entrenched reasons why certain people can't climb up the ladder as well. I think it definitely does take time out of the day to kind of engage with some of those challenges. But I think that's something that we can definitely all take away in order to really make systemic changes post COP26.
Thanks, Juliet. Lois, over to you.
I completely agree with what's been said already. I think the main thing is to encourage more women to be involved in the conversation in the first place. I mean, I really like what Jo said earlier about being brave. So it's all about backing yourself, to use the Women to Win phrase, ask her to stand. So not just in politics or policymaking, in your career as well. I think women often look at a job interview that somebody mentioned earlier. We have this imposter syndrome that if we can't do everything on the list, we shouldn't apply. I think the main takeaway for me is to be brave.
Thanks, Lois. Jo, over to you.
I've got to think of something else now, haven't I? I would just, I think we're all violently agreeing. It's take the reality of, you know, the situation we're in. Climate change and diversity are the two topics that, you know, people don't disagree on. So actually the door is marginally open for us. And if we're all brave and say it as it is, you know, say the reality of how it feels, what you know, it's always easy just to sort of join in with the conversation, but be brave and you know, change the conversation.
Thanks, Jo. And last but not least, Rebecca.
Yeah, echo what everyone else has said. I'd say just one more point: to never underestimate the impact you can have. Sometimes really small questions or really small observations on the status quo to the right person can have a really big impact and ripple change throughout an organization or in the way people think. So don't, if you're thinking it in your head and your kind of sixth spider sense is feeling it, sometimes it's really worth pointing out to others who might be blind to it to help deliver change.
Great, thank you so much. Lots of food for thought today, and I'd say give us all applause, but given it Zoom, a virtual applause to our excellent speakers today. So thank you so much, and thank you to the Women's Utilities Network. Hayley, I don't know if you want to come in with some final words, but that's everything from our side, and have a great day.
Yeah, thanks very much. It was a really great session. So thanks everybody for coming along. In terms of Women's Utility Network, we don't have any planned events at this side of Christmas. So great opportunity to wish everybody a great time off over the festive period. We currently have planned our first in-person event for early February. So I know everyone's going to be super excited about getting back together again. So that is going to be early February, and the date and the details, location and everything are going to be published shortly. So do keep an eye on what's happening on social media and on the Women's Utility Network website, and we'll update you on what's happening there.
Thank you. Can I quickly just ask the speakers just to smile at the camera whilst I do a very quick print screen? Is that okay? Okay, already? I'm going to do a count you all down. So 3, 2, 1, smile. Lovely. I've got it. Thank you so much. Have a nice day. Take care.
Thanks, everyone. Bye. See you later.
Bye.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.